looking at the subject of money from a Christian perspective. If you've not met me before, I'm Dave Green. I'm a local maths teacher, and this is the second of our perspective discussions. We did one on gender about 5 weeks ago, and this one is on the subject of money. And we're hoping that it's going to be a starting point, or at least it's going to be a moving along point for your thinking. I would imagine that there are going to be things this evening you might not necessarily agree with, or that you might not have thought about before, but we're hoping that in the next 60 minutes or so, it'll get you thinking, get you going back to your Bibles, and reflecting what a Christian worldview looks like on this particular subject. We're going to be looking at capitalism to start off with this evening. Winston Churchill, well, apologies to him, he was talking about democracy, but this worked quite well as a quote. And capitalism seems to have been the dominant economic system as we have gone through the last 40 or 50 years. In the UK, we have a form of that. Private business makes profits for investors and shareholders. Government uses taxes to provide social services and things like education and health and defence, and leaves business largely to the task of creating jobs and wealth. And in terms of the big picture, capitalism's effect on the world seems very, very impressive. Last year, there was a book written by a Scandinavian journalist called Johan Norberg, who is titled Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. And he documented some of the things that you may not be aware of statistically that have happened in the last few hundred years, many of which are influenced heavily by capitalism. So, for instance, food. 100 years ago, it took 25 men all day to harvest and thresh a ton of grain. A modern combine harvester and a single person can now do that in 6 minutes. The average life expectancy in 1900 was 31. Today it's 71. Extreme poverty across the world has gone from 44% of the population in only 1980 to under 10% in 2015. And the number of countries where slavery was legalized in 1800 was just under 60. It now stands at zero. And finally, equality. In 1900, only one country in the world allowed women to vote, New Zealand. Now women are excluded for only two countries, Saudi Arabia and the Vatican City. So the track record of modernization and capitalism looks quite impressive. But also there seems to be a downside. If you look at the UK, we seem to have incredible wealth in the UK alongside significant poverty. These statistics are between 2009 and 2015. So the number of billionaires in that time has doubled. The pay of top company directors increased by 40%. Number of people using food banks has increased from 26,000 to nearly 1 million. And the average UK worker has experienced a 9% real term pay cut. So, what do we think about capitalism and how can we apply the Bible to this economic system? Well, I'm going to have a chat to Dave now. And we're going to just do a little interview. So I wonder if you can step forward, Dave. We had a very civilized couple of hours chat in the sunshine. Must have been about a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, Dave?
It was.
And I'm going to ask Dave to kind of praise some of those ideas. I've got three questions for him. Just in terms of background, Dave, you've worked as a director for JCB.
Yeah.
And you're now the chair of governors of the JCB Academy.
Yeah.
And you've also seen internationally the effects of capitalism and socialism, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. All right, let's go with the first question. Why do you think capitalism has been so successful?
As you say, I think the evidence is quite overwhelming. So I've had the privilege of travelling behind the Iron Curtain to communist countries before the Iron Curtain came down, to Russia, to China, to which are clearly communist countries, to Latin America, spent quite a bit of time in Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, socialist countries. And this week I was just in France, which in Europe, France would be more socialist, certainly, than the UK is. And, I mean, obviously to a Christian, socialism seems like a great concept. It seems right. It seems like a fairer way to run the country. But the evidence is that it just doesn't seem to work. When I went to China, I studied a lot of China, about China. In 1966, when I was 16, and, you know, the Beatles were at number one, Chairman Mao was doing his Great Leap Forward, where basically all wealth was taken away from everybody. It was collective farming, collective everything, so nobody owned anything in 1966. And, by the way, 30 to 40 million people starved in that Great Leap Forward, which really was a great leap backwards. Now, today, you mentioned billionaires. China has the second number of billionaires to anywhere else in the world. So in 1966, nobody owned anything, and now there are 313 billionaires in the UK. It's in single numbers. So the problem with... I don't like the greed... but there is something about people that is selfish, wanting to better oneself, that communism and socialism seems to thwart. And therefore, what it breeds is corruption. So you've got Putin is the richest person in the world, apparently, leader of a communist country. You've got Abramovich running Chelsea, a billionaire, multi-billionaire, has got his money from oil and gas. Well, it wasn't his oil and gas in the first place, as far as I can see. He just, I mean, it's a strong word, but he stole it from the people of Russia. So while you've got these billionaires in China, you've got abject poverty. And then you look at Venezuela and you look at Argentina, countries that are very rich and in resources that are bankrupt, basically. They've failed their debt. They're in a terrible state. Now, they're socialist countries. And I read this quote because I knew I was doing this 2 weeks ago. This was in, I take a magazine called The Week, and it says this: a government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always rely on the support of Paul. And that was George Bernard Shaw. So a government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always rely on the on the support of Paul. And basically, that's what's happened in Argentina and Venezuela. They're communist countries. They've basically taken the wealth, bought the votes, and they stay in power. And as they stay in power, the country gradually goes down the tubes. So the reason, and if you go to France, which is just so, you know, coming much closer to home, the airline is owned by the government, the car companies are owned by the government, all the electricity, all the big companies are basically government-owned, and most of them are close to failing or have been bought by somebody. Air France is, you know, just about to go under. So, and unemployment in France for youth is 20%, and for overall is 10%, so it's double what it is in this country. So, this great idea of socialism, in my view, doesn't really work.
I was going to summarise. So what you're saying, Dave, is that there is something about capitalism that harnesses that sense of entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
And does the wealth creation.
Yeah.
You're going with that.
I mean, I believe that God is a creator, and I believe that we are born to be creative. We're born to work hard and be rewarded for that work. And that's what I saw at JCB. I was going to give the example. I'm glad Steve's here. So we're in a free capitalist market. He works for Caterpillar. I work for JCB. And it's a competitive market. So I'm sure this happens, but, you know, Caterpillar would bring out a new machine. We'd buy it. We'd look at it. We'd think, oh, that's better. Yeah, well, they made a mess of that. Or we can do that better. And he would be, Caterpillar would get one of our machines, take it to bits, see how they could make it better. And so this sort of competitive spirit would lead to better machines, better service, and that's what you see today. And then you see when the government owns a business like British Leyland, you know, they're rubbish at it. They just can't do it. So somehow, I think, we were created to be enterprising, and we were created to, you know, certainly when I was working, I'm sure Jeff would say the same at Rolls-Royce, you know, there is a feeling the better I do my job, the better the company will be, and the better I will be rewarded for it, either with promotion or with... And somehow that seems to work, whereas when government owns businesses, it doesn't seem to work as well.
Okay, so that's a fairly persuasive case. People might not agree with that, and feel free to pick that up later on. Capitalism's had a bit of a bloody nose in the last 10 years, though, it would be fair to say, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Banking crisis and I guess public service workers in real terms, salaries going down, all sorts of other things. What do you think of the big weakness of capitalism is?
I think the biggest weakness is the same weakness that we have. God gave us free choice, free will. And the issue with capitalism is that if that free choice and free will is abused, then things go pear-shaped. So in the banking crisis, greed, risk, irresponsibility happened. And if those things happen, then lots of people suffer. And so the biggest issue with it is that if companies aren't driven properly, then a lot of people get burned. This is one of my favourite books. It's called Built to Last. And this is a book about companies that last, companies that don't fall down the tubes. And we can think, you know, I don't mean British Leyland. I mean lots of so-called good companies that fail. And they fail for the same reasons. They fail because of short-termism. They fail because their total focus is on profits. And they fail because they don't look after their stakeholders. And this book is trying to, while I like it, it was teaching me that if you do those things, the company won't last. To build a good company, you have to do things properly, you have to be looking for more than profits, and you have to look after your stakeholders, your employees, your customers, the community around you. You know, this isn't an advert for JCB, but the JCB Academy is there because Lord Bamford cares about the community and cares about engineering in Britain, and so he's put millions into building a school. So that's the sort of thing that I mean about it's more important than... And if you don't do those things, you know, you'll fail.
Yes.
And people will get... The sad thing is people will get burned through it.
Yes. Last question. We talked about a number of things. For me, one of the most interesting questions I had for you was thinking about the Bible and thinking about the UK economic system at the moment. What would you change to bring the UK capitalist system, or whatever it is at the moment, but the UK economic system, to a point where it's closer to the ideals of the Bible?
Yeah, that's a simple question, isn't it? I think several things, really. I'm not keen on regulation. because the more regulation you bring in, the more you thwart creativity and the more you damage things. So I think you have to be very careful about regulation. I think thinking about what would I do legally? I find it very hard that people like Philip Green can ruin a company and carry on almost as though nothing had happened. And he was shamed really into sorting the pension out. It wasn't because he probably would have been caught by the law. Mm. I find it terrible that you can have somebody who starts in business, fails in business, hurts a lot of people, and then they're in business again with a new name and operating next week. So there is something about when things fail,
yeah,
we need to be much stricter at punishing people, frankly, and preventing them from doing more damage. We talked a lot about tax. Obviously, we've just had an election, and tax is always a big thing. I like the quote, you might know why I like it, but that you'll never make a poor man rich by making a rich man poor. But I do believe that. I do believe that it is far better to draw people up. I've seen it in India. When JCB started in India, the car park was empty. You go to India today and there are hundreds of cars there. Hundreds of people have been taken out of poverty. And that's because of enterprise that's lifting people out of poverty rather than government taxing and then trying to, give people money to. I think there is something about people working to get out rather than. And so, but coming back to this country, we have got big issues. We are still borrowing more than we're spending. And the only way you can raise money is through tax. Now, whether it's taxing the rich, taxing big business, Derby would be hurt if we tax big business. Our city relies on Rolls-Royce, Toyota, Bombardier, JCB to bring wealth into the business. They've got choices to where they go. And so taxing big business, taxing the rich sounds great, but I think there are big risks with doing that. But I do believe that we probably do need to generate more income through tax. My biggest concern is I don't trust government to spend it very well. So I think you could raise billions more for the health service and it would disappear. I think you could raise billions more for other social services and they wouldn't spend it well. So my fear is the capability of government to spend money. They can generate it, but it's the spending bit I'm worried about.
Can I stop you there, Dave?
Yes.
Because that's a perfect way to move into the next activity. Thank you so much for spending time talking to us about that.
That was Dave sharing his views, and hopefully that's got you thinking, either agreeing with him or disagreeing or a combination of the two. I think a couple of weeks ago I'd have said that, if you fancy your job as a Chancellor of the Exchequer, there's probably a role there for somebody. I'm guessing you probably know what you're doing with National Insurance. But maybe Philip Hammond's going to be staying there for a while now. Let's have a look at that whole economics thing just for one more time. And then I want to focus on more our personal response as Christians. A number of years ago, I spent some time working with a guy called Michael Schluter, who's got an organization called the Jubilee Center in Cambridge. And they've been doing some work, some really interesting work on the Old Testament. I don't know if any of you have tried that whole kind of reading the Bible in a year, and you get to Leviticus, and oh my word, it's kind of dry going. But Michael Schluter was a World Bank economist. And what he did is he started looking at the Old Testament from the views of an economist. And he said, what's going on is really, really interesting. If you look at the kind of things that we've been talking about so far, the state and its involvement in economics, the extent to which individuals have capital and an opportunity to show their entrepreneurial skills, there's a lot going on in the Old Testament. Those early or middle chapters of Joshua where they're going through which family gets the land. Oh my word, that's dry. But the interesting thing is, if you think about it, that means that every single person, every member of the children of Israel, had an item of capital. At the time, it was an agricultural economy. So it was land. But they'd got a portion of land for that family. And so, regardless of who you were, there was no slavery going on in the nation at the time. There was no landed serfs and that kind of thing. There was just families who had a plot of land. And that was the starting point. And there are really very few constraints in the Old Testament at that point about what those families did. So lots of freedom to use that entrepreneurial skills, that creativity, to actually generate wealth. And it was envisaged, I guess, that some would be more successful than others. And so there was like a 50-year reset button, the year of Jubilee. And in the year of Jubilee, if people had fallen on hard times and had to lease back their land, the land reverted back to the original families. So it was capital and entrepreneurialism and it was creativity, but with a safeguard. At a certain point, all that land would return to the original families. Interestingly, there was also a limited role for the state. So the state didn't have a massive overarching role to play. In fact, Deuteronomy talks quite clearly, Deuteronomy 17, another one of those books that you probably struggle to get through, but it prescribes very tightly the monarchy. The monarchy was not to get beyond itself. It wasn't to become some massive administration machine. It had certain roles, but largely it should not be affecting the life of ordinary Israelites. And so you had capital, you had opportunity, you had a limited role for the state, and you also had a safety net in those circumstances where people face adversity. You even had something for those people who'd really got nothing at all. Have a look at the book of Ruth, and you see Ruth gleaning down the fields. Even in the early Old Testament, you see that it's made very clear that when you do the harvesting, you don't do it exhaustively. You leave stuff for the poor. So that safety net for those people who'd fallen on hard times. So next time you look at those books in the Old Testament, and I'm going to put on the reading list later on a paper written by an economist called Paul Mills, who explores this in a lot more depth, the way that the Old Testament speaks to these economic themes. But the Old Testament has a great deal to say about the sort of state that we might want in this country. Now, clearly, we've moved from a primitive agricultural economy to something much more technological, but some of those principles still work. Okay, I want to switch focus a little bit and start talking about our individual responses and think about what we might do personally with our wealth. One of the interesting things about the New Testament is the way that Jesus talks about money rather a lot. And it's fascinating to see how that impacted on people. Financial embezzlers returning their ill-gotten gains. Rich professionals giving money to support Jesus' movement. People giving up their careers to be part of something that they thought was the most important thing in their lives. I want to share with you a letter which I read a number of years ago. And this letter is actually written by a communist. So it's an ideology I don't necessarily agree with. But it struck me that this person has an extraordinary level of commitment. And it was written as he broke off his engagement to somebody. And he writes these words: "We communists suffer many casualties. We are those whom they shoot, hang, lynch, tar and feather, in prison, slander, fire from our jobs, and whose lives people make miserable in every way possible. Some of us are killed and imprisoned. We live in poverty. From what we can earn, we turn over to the party every cent which we do not absolutely need to live. We communists have neither time nor money to go to the movies very often, nor for concerts, nor for beautiful homes and new cars. They call us fanatics. We are fanatics. Our lives are dominated by one supreme factor, the struggle for world communism. We communists have a philosophy of life that money could not buy. We have a cause to fight for, a specific goal in life. We lose our insignificant identities in the great river of humanity. And if our personal lives seem hard, or if our egos seem bruised through subordination to the party, we are amply rewarded in the thought that all of us, even if it be in a very small way, are contributing something new and better for humanity. There is one thing about which I am completely in earnest, the communist cause. It is my life, my business, my religion, my hobby, my sweetheart, my wife, my mistress, my meat and drink. I work at it by day and I dream of it by night. Its control over me grows greater with the passage of time. Therefore, I cannot have a friend, a lover, or even a conversation without relating them to this power that animates and controls my life. I measure people, books, ideas, and deeds according to the way they affect the communist cause and by their attitude to it. I have already been in jail for my ideas, and if need be, I'm ready to face death. And that extraordinary letter was written by somebody who was following a cause, which I guess has largely been discredited now. And it just made me think about the New Testament church, how even more they were completely sold out. Those early passages in Acts where the believers talk about giving their money away. And so I thought it might be useful to bring this to a more kind of personal point. In your groups, what I'd like you to do is thinking about the world we live in and particularly about the things that stop us being the people we want to be. What stops us being more generous? And I want to broaden that out, not just about money, but about our time, our resources, our careers, and our money. What stops us being more generous? I wonder if you could tackle that one question for about 10 minutes. Off you go. I wonder how you got on with that question. Does anybody feel bold enough to offer a starting point, a response to what stops us being more generous? If you want to put your hand in the air, we'll get a mic to you.
This is probably a mistake. Working? Yeah, it is now. Right, this is probably a mistake, but never mind. We came to one conclusion about... Yeah. About what stops me, and that is not knowing the needs.
Okay. So a lack of information.
We are not the sort of community that's pictured in the first part of Acts.
Okay.
All right, where everyone knew about everyone else's needs.
Right, okay. So a barrier to being more generous is an absence of useful information about that. Okay. Anybody want to respond to that at all? Agree?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, Steve was saying that if, for instance, LMC had a very specific project that we knew we could make a very specific difference to,
yes,
we would probably think, yes.
You'd get behind
I'd
it.
I'd get behind
it
that.
It would capture the imagination.
Giving money to general stuff doesn't quite...
Make the heart race.
Doesn't
yes.
quite get you going.
Yeah, that's helpful. Okay. Any other barriers to generosity? Gareth.
This isn't my point, but I just thought it was so valuable that it ought to be shared, really. And that is that the starting point for any aspect of generosity, from the Christian perspective anyway, is that everything we have belongs to God.
Yeah.
He is the owner of all things. And the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And although it's right to say that, and quite another thing to believe it and live it, if we can enter into that perspective more and more and more and more,
yeah,
then in a couple of our experiences, at least here, the giving over of things, the being generous, whether it's time, money, possession, whatever, becomes that bit easier because yeah. we realise it's only ours on loan anyway. So that wasn't my... I didn't make that point, but I just thought it was profound
yeah,
and was important to be shared.
Any other comments? Last one, and then I think we'll close.
It was just something we opened with, I thought, and was selfishness of our own that is a barrier, or what was it you said, self-centeredness.
yes.
as well. It could be a barrier.
Yeah.
And then we discussed it.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I think in combination sometimes with a kind of comparison game, I know in my head, if I'm wanting to justify an expenditure, I sometimes look at other people in my peer group and think, well, that'll be okay because they bought one of those. Rather than an absolute sense of do I need it or not. I think sometimes, I thought Rob Bell's comments were very helpful. If our starting point is that we are the rich, then maybe we'll look at our wealth in a slightly different way and acknowledge the fact that we have huge amounts of luxuries compared to the rest of the world. I want to draw this to a close. Obviously, feel free to carry on your conversations. Ask me any questions you like. I might even have the odd answer. You never know. But what I'd like to do, if you're okay, is just finish with a word of prayer. And then we can carry on our conversations informally.